Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and overall well-being. And thank you for joining me and being part of this community and the ongoing conversations that I have every week. I know that these conversations are so important to me, and I'm sure that you are receiving as well great value from the expertise of my guests and the breadth of conversations that I have. I really like to expand our awareness and tap into all sorts of different perspectives and realms. And that's why we're having a conversation today with Dr. Stephen Leib, who has been a guest before. He's a wonderful, inspiring guest. We're going to be talking about the most important information for your economic well-being. And before I introduce Dr. Leib, let me just share a little bit about him. Stephen Leib is the author of China's Rise and the New Age of Gold, How Investors Can Profit from a Changing World, and editor of the award-winning publication, The Complete Investor. The author of 8 previous books, Dr. Leib is known for his ability to uncover overlooked trends and explaining what they mean for investors, often going against conventional wisdom. He predicted the bull market that started in the 1980s in his book, Getting In on the Ground Floor, foresaw the tech stock crash in defying the market, profiting in the turbulent post-technology market boom, and forecasted the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis in his New York Best Times seller, The Coming Economic Collapse, How You Can Thrive When Oil Costs $200 a Barrel, co-authored with Glenn Strathi. Dr. Leib is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business and holds a PhD in psychology and a master's in mathematics from the University of Illinois. And he is a frequent guest on national financial shows and a speaker at major conferences. So it's just such a pleasure to have Dr. Leib back on the show. So I first want to welcome you, Stephen, and thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cheryl. It's always my pleasure.
You know, I'm just so happy we can have a continuing conversation because I don't know how anyone else is feeling out there, but I am just following trends and information. You know, it's not my expertise, but I am really curious because we know we are living in extraordinary times. We know that all this money that is being printed, that is extraordinary. And I know people have so many questions and what's going on, and there's such a sense of uncertainty and anxiety. At least, you know, it is for me, and I'm sure that there are other people out there that feel the same way. It's like, what's the best way to go? How do we navigate times of uncertainty? And this is your forte. You have this ability through, you know, your education and probably just a really unique intuitive sense of things, of the emerging cycle we're in, the emerging trends that are happening around us that probably most of us aren't aware of because we're just not as invested in this journey right now. So I have one question before we jump into this that I'm curious about. And that is, you know, as someone who has a PhD in psychology, mathematics, you know, you're so well schooled in that area. I want to know, what was it that got you into investing and understanding market trends? Was there something that happened, an event that turned your direction around?
Well, you know, not really, Cheryl. I mean, it was basically a kind of recognition of how little that we knew about almost anything, from psychology to even physics, which is, you know, still the case today. We don't know a whole lot as a species. I mean, we're still developing the kind of knowledge that we are going to need in order to maintain our place in this world. And, you know, investing is a way that combines a lot of different disciplines, economics, psychology, certainly math, and, you know, just problem solving in general. And it requires to get anywhere in this discipline, it requires a sort of dedication to objective problem solving. Hype and opinion. Yes, you have to in the end intuitively sum up what you know, but it has to be backed up by facts and facts from just different areas. Psychological facts, real facts on the ground, and has to be summarized, and the math and everything else that I, have studied helps do this. And sometimes I get it right, and, I would say that my batting average is pretty good. But, I don't bat 100, and I want to emphasize that. I certainly am wrong on a case, I'm wrong sometimes, but I'm right more than I'm wrong. And what I see today, unfortunately, I like being a person that soothes other people. That's why I, studied psychology. I mean, I like to give people good news, not necessarily bad news. I'm very happy. I think I spent a good part of my career, or at least from the 80s to, maybe throughout the 90s, being called the perpetual bull, which I was on stocks. And now, over the last generation, the last 20 years, it's definitely moderated, and it's moderated substantially. And, starting in in mid-century, when we had the collapse in the financial markets, my view really shifted, I would say, fairly dramatically. I mean, up to that point, I'd always thought that, gold on occasion might be a good investment. I began thinking that it might be a better investment as the new century dawned, because, I did foresee that China would play a much more important role in the world. By 2011, I was convinced that China's role in the world would be incredibly important, and if we weren't careful, it would probably usurp our own. And unfortunately, and I say very unfortunately, that has come to pass. And the consequences are that we're now looking at a planet in which all countries basically are growing all at once. Until really this century. And I would say almost the second half of this century, the developing world was not a world, even though it constitutes 85% of the world's population, it really wasn't growing. I mean, for most of the period after the Second World War, the growth in the world really took place and was almost totally concentrated in the developing world, the developed world. I mean, the Western world, America, Europe, they grew. But the rest of the world really did not. I mean, in some cases, there were 10-year periods in which they went backwards. But now that the entire world is growing and the developing world, I mean, for the first time, in modern history, the developing world is actually larger than the developed world, and is growing much faster. That's a very, very unusual set of circumstances, and it's going to continue like that. And, basically, you're at a point. I mean, we in this country, unfortunately, take things like commodities for granted. We don't pay much attention to them. We know that they have cycles. They go up and down. Basically, this is not that. I mean, those were the rules for most of the time in that I was growing up and in this business. But lately, and especially I would say starting in this second generation of this century, I don't think that's going to be the case. I think that commodity shortages are going to be much more the rule than they've ever been before. And I think that they're going to be persistent. I mean, there may be breaks. But if you look at just the first 20 years of this century, what very few people will really point out, and it's just a matter, again, it's just looking at the data. When you say, why did I take all this, these academic subjects, et cetera, I mean, basically to try and solve problems. And one thing you have to look at when you solve problems is what actually is going on. What does the real data, the reliable what do the reliable numbers tell you? And in the first 20 years, they tell you that gold outperformed financial assets by 200 basis points. They went up gold. If you just buried gold in your backyard, your money multiplied fivefold versus if you invested in the S&P, dividends reinvested, et cetera, you only multiplied your assets by threefold over 20 years, fivefold in gold. But it wasn't just gold. Gold was the leader in terms of commodities, but it was also silver that outperformed the S&P 500, copper that outperformed the S&P 500. And my goodness, iron ore that outperformed the S&P 500. That was the first generation. Now, as we approach the second generation, the developing world is on a firmer base, and I think their demand for commodities is even going to be greater. And it's going to be, I think, the first generation on steroids, especially when you consider that there's a concomitant, a concurrent, and all an additional need to develop in the context of creating a renewable society, a renewable world, a world that's running on renewable energies. That's just got to be the way it happens. We're running out of, you know, we can't rely on things that we're going to run out of eventually. We have to start relying on things that we're going to have plenty of, like the sun. That's the major thing. We have to build a world around our sun, for lack of a better phrase. The sun we can count on. The oceans we can count on. And these are the things we really have to use much more of in order to develop our planet. And, you know, basically, climate change sits on top of this as something that is pressuring us even more. I mean, one thing you do learn when you look at math and you study, you know, how much we can possibly know about particular things, you really can't know what's going to happen 30 or 40 years from now. There's no way that these, very elaborate climate models are going to be, you know, exactly correct. They may be even wrong. But we do know over the next 3 or 4 years, it's very likely that, you know, the climate model that would not so much the model, but just the fact that we're putting a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, that's going to continue to warm us. And, you know, who knows after that? I mean, our understanding of, you know, there are so many factors that enter into, you know, what causes climate that are not part of these models, like tilting the axis of the earth of just, I'm talking millimeters, can have dramatic effects, et cetera. We can't build that in. We don't know. I do know, and everybody knows, or at least supposedly no one was there to actually attest to it, but, you know, there have been plenty of ice ages, and there have been plenty of warm periods in the, you know, huge long-term geological past. So, you know, things can happen. But right now what is happening is that the world is getting warmer. It's likely to continue to get warmer for a while longer. We don't know, again, 50 years from now, but 3 to 5 years, the odds, I would say, are very strong the world is going to get warmer, and it may continue from there. But regardless of where of how strongly you believe that science, it's still the case that you need to develop a world in which you have sustainable, renewable energies. And you're doing this in the context of a world in which everybody is developing at the same time. And I'm afraid that there's going to be a lot of turmoil. And, you know, I listen to, you know, what people are talking about now, and they seem to just overlook some of the major trends that are right in front of us, right as we speak now. You can go to any stock screen, go to any brokerage firm and just ask them to show you a chart of, X, Y, or Z, and you'll see it for yourself. You know, you have straight lines, and some of those lines are stronger than anything that we've seen in a century. I don't want to go on too more. I'm sure you have questions, and I'll be happy to end.
You know, when you talk about commodities, what specifically are you referring to? Which commodities are going to be getting, let's just say there'll be more competition for them? Because that's what I hear you saying, is countries develop and they want more of what we have, right? And either that's
exactly
the raw materials,
right.
Go ahead.
And the gaps are enormous. I mean, you know, you have a per capita income gap between, let's say, the developed world and the developing world of 5 to 1 at least. I mean, that's going to take, you know, decades to catch up. So I'm not even betting that will, you know, that I'm just hoping that does narrow, but it's not going to, you know, fully catch up. Yes, it's massive, the gap. And the commodities that I'm talking about right now in front of me, Cheryl, I have a graph of what's called the Commodity Research Bureau U.S. spot all commodities, all. This is a measure of prices actually paid for an entire basket of commodities, from corn to scrap copper, from wheat to any food stuff that you could name. It's all included in this chart. I mean, this is, you know, an average of prices that are paid. It's not, you know, prices that you pay on exchanges for, you know, paper representations of these commodities. These are prices that are being paid right now as we speak, you know, as of last Friday. If you look at this chart, it tells you that the average prices paid in the last 12 months have increased over 50%. Now, that's probably, from what I can tell, it's certainly one of the largest increases we've ever seen in commodity prices. And, you know, I don't have any example of a greater increase that we've seen in a 12-month period for at least a century. And when you start going back a century, you're not talking about a huge basket of commodities. My goodness, you know, a lot of commodities in this index weren't even around then. But today, you know, you have a massive basket of commodities that's increasing at a rate that we've probably never seen before. And we're just sort of getting off the ground. I mean, you know, some of these commodities like copper, silver, you know, many more, zinc, are going to be just essential in driving the growth that we're going to need. And it's just not clear that we're going to be able to connect all these dots. And especially sitting here in this wonderful country of ours, America, a country, you know, that, you know, until the early 70s was unmatched probably in the history of any, you know, major country. I mean, America was a great country. I mean, it always had, you know, things that were wrong with it, et cetera, even in the 1950s. But it was a great country in the up to the early 70s. We all shared, and it was a mutually shared prosperity. And then things started going haywire for, you know, lots of reasons. I mean, I think one in particular is that we lost all sense of financial discipline, none whatsoever. And with that loss, with that really, you know, part and parcel was coming off the gold standard. There was no reason that we had to have financial discipline. And like children in a candy shop, we just spent ourselves silly and created, in the end, I think, a terrible mess where instead of being farsighted and developing, you know, inventions that would serve us in the future, like the transistor, like the laser, like the internet, these all came out of America. They all came out of, in particular, Bell Labs, which was basically a subsidiary of a private company, AT&T, which worked with the government, which worked with major academic institutions, and created this new world of technology for us. But, you know, by the time that we, you know, this new world of technology required, you know, probably the best example would be the transistor. I mean, it was, but it took maybe 20 years before people realized how important, you know, an invention in the 1940s was going to be. And right now, since the, at least since the 1970s, early 70s, there's no long-term vision anymore in this country. And it's very unfortunate. And, you know, if I had to cite, you know, an example, sorry to, you know, go on this riff, but it's so important to try and realize this. I mean, you know, AT&T, which was at the center of creating all this new technologies, that all the technology all was new then, and it's still foundational today, even though we basically have lost track in it. We're no longer the dominant players in any of the things that we created. It's unbelievable. And, you know, the reason that happened is that we lost all sense of financial discipline, and everything became immediate gratification. And possibly one of the best examples of this, and then I'll be quiet after I mention this, but one of the best examples is when we decided to break up AT&T, the very organization that took us to where we are today, that took us to where we were back in the 80s when we decided to break it up for competitive reasons. I mean, we broke it up because, in my opinion, okay, this is opinion. It's not opinion that we broke it up. We did. But it, and it's not opinion that in breaking it up, we basically destroyed Bell Labs, the heart and soul of all this creative activity. But, you know, my opinion is that we broke it up because there was a big, huge payday for the financial industry. Whenever there's a merger, acquisition, or breaking apart of a country, of a company, I said country, maybe that was a Freudian slip, you know, there's massive paydays for the financial industry. And everybody in the financial industry made a lot of money when we broke up AT&T, but we took another big downward step in keeping up with the technologies that we had made possible. And that's kind of continuing today. And you see this with our ignorance about commodities. We are dependent on, you know, most of the rest of the world for all these vital commodities. At least to some extent we're dependent, and some we're 100% dependent. And for some of the very critical commodities, like rare earths, like germanium, there's a number of them which are really critical for, you know, further technology improvement. We don't make any of those. And, you know, to add to it, I mean, we're totally dependent on China for a lot of these commodities. It just doesn't make sense what's going on in this world. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a reckoning here, Cheryl. It's mm-hmm. almost unavoidable. And, you know, coming back to the practicalities of what you can do, I mean, we were talking before, and you asked me about, you know, putting money into a metal ETF or mutual fund. That makes a lot of sense. It makes tremendous sense to invest in gold, to invest in silver, to invest in commodities. I'm not saying it should be 100% of your portfolio. I'm not giving that kind of advice. But it should be a meaningful part of your portfolio, in my opinion. And if you want a justification and you want to just say, well, this guy just goes on and on and on, well, just look at the data yourself. Look at what's going on with commodities. You know, walk into a brokerage office and ask them to show you a chart of the CRB, raw industrials. Ask them to, you know, on their own, you know, terminals to calculate what were the best performing assets in the first generation of this century. That should convince you, period. That you know, is all you really need to be convinced, because you'll find out that what I'm saying is fact. It's not some sort of, you know, crazy conspiracy that you're going to read about on Facebook. It's just what is happening now. And when you take into account what's happening right now, you know, there's a lot of possible conclusions, but going to the heart of what is happening is commodities are getting scarcer, and that has been happening for 20 years, and there's every reason to believe it's accelerating. So, you know, if I can just impart one bit of advice for your listeners, you know, pay attention to that. Invest in ETFs or mutual funds that focus on metals. Invest in mutual funds that focus on gold and ETFs that focus on gold. if you're, you know, want to really be a little bit more sophisticated, which I would not discourage, you know, go to the internet and find out how to buy physical gold and how to store it. I mean, there are companies around that'll do that for you. That could also be an alternative. I mean, the nice thing about gold, in particular about gold, is that there's lots of ways of buying it. You don't have to go near the stock market to do it. There's lots of ways in investing. There's nothing wrong with buying gold coins or silver coins, for example. That's a fine way of investing and a fine way of protecting you and your families. So, you know, that's basically, you know, a lot of my message in, well, I guess I can't say a nutshell because I was going on for quite a while. But hopefully, you know, you can see the rationale behind it. And, you know, it's not something you have to take my word for. It's something that you can go and ask about. Just ask the right questions and you'll get these answers. And realize that, you know, your financial advisors are not going to tell you this. And here I'm speculating, not really. They're not going to tell you commodities and gold are so important because they don't make any money selling commodities. They really don't. They make a lot of money selling stocks and bonds and breaking up companies and merging companies, et cetera. But if you want to know what's going on, just say, you know, how have commodities done over the past 12 months? Show me a chart of the CRB, raw industrials, our, you know, total commodity, all commodities. And you'll see straight up. Well, how did gold do the first 20 years of this century? And you'll see exactly what I told you. Use those facts to make your decision. Don't trust, you know, so-called experts. There's a reason experts have fallen out of favor in this society is because it's not their fault. It's just the society has become very short-term oriented and very oriented toward an immediate payday. And you just have to step away from that and find a way of convincing yourself there's some other truth out there. And it's a real truth. It's something you can see in black and white. It's no one's opinion. It's just what's happened.
So do you see as you look down the track several years, I don't know, 2, 3, 5, do you see a reckoning with the economy and the stock market?
I certainly see the potential of that happening, yes. I think things are going to be very tumultuous. I think that you're going to see, look, does it really make a lot of sense to see inflation in this country reported to be, let's say, somewhere around 2.5% right now, and the Federal Reserve saying, well, that's an anomaly, but not an anomaly because it's a low, it's an anomaly because it's high. And, you know, 2% inflation is high in the context of broad-based commodity indexes going up by over 50%. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, it's just loony to say that. And it's what you read and hear. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I think if you pay a visit to your grocery store, you'll see that I'm right. I mean, food prices are, you know, though they go through various stages, and raw foods, which is what I'm looking at, it takes a while for raw foods to reach, you know, the supermarket shelves in terms of pricing, but they do. They will. And, you know, you're going to see things that are not 2%, but things that are considerably more than 2%. So you really have to be prepared for that. And I think it's going to be a situation that if you live through the 70s, you have some idea of what can happen. And I think that kind of situation is going to repeat itself, except this time it might be, you know, somewhat worse. And I think you have to sort of steel yourself to that and, you know, prepare. And, you know, financially, the best advice I can give you is probably own gold. Focus on gold, but, you know, any commodity. I mean, commodities should be a central point, I think, in your investment decisions.
Well, you know, this is such an important conversation, Stephen. This is, for me, it's a really important conversation. Someone who wants to secure the resources I have, but, you know, have never really, it's not my area of expertise. So I look to people who I trust, and I really trust what you are saying in your research is one of the more wiser voices out there. And, you know, we're going to end the conversation here. This is kind of our part one. People, stay tuned. Christina's going to come back, and we're going to do part two of this interview. And then we're going to go into some really important discussions that we touched on before, Stephen, but I think it needs to be touched on again, and that's the Bitcoin versus gold, the two camps. And
yes.
I want your opinion on that, because it's really important to have an understanding. If you're going to make these investments, you want to listen to some sound wisdom on this subject before you begin.
And sure, I just want to conclude by saying one thing. I appreciate the compliment that you, you know, trust what I say. I truly appreciate that. I mean, you know, it means a lot to me. But I don't want you to trust me. I want you to trust yourself. And I want you just to know what the right questions to ask people are. And don't let them get off. Just ask them, how have commodities performed over the last 12 months? And ask them, what were the leading investments in the first 20 years of this century? And, you know, and then if you want to ask them, why no one is talking about this? Why is no one talking about gold having been the best investment over the past 20 years? And why is no one talking about this historic rise we've had in commodities over the past 12 months? So I appreciate that you're trusting me, but it's really important that I impart you with the ability to, you know, ask the right questions so that you can trust yourself and know that, you know, you're making a sound decision. I don't want you, anyone just following me. I want them to, you know, have it in their DNA that this is what's going on out there and this is what they have to do.
Well,
and we can continue
and
this later.
I appreciate that, because we need more knowledge in order to make informed decisions, right? So that's why we're having this conversation. So I know you need to go. We're going to be continuing this conversation. So I'll let Stephen go for the moment, and then we'll have part two of this interview. Thanks, Stephen. We'll see you back here in a minute. And for everyone else, hang in there, because we have part two coming right up.
Look forward to it, Cheryl. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Well, this is part two of my conversation with Dr. Stephen Leeb. We're going to continue this this really important conversation. And I want us to move to the area that I think creates so much confusion, certainly does in my mind, and that is the cryptocurrency blockchain world and the gold, silver bullion world. As far as where do we want to consider investing, what's the area that would be the safest and also most productive? So that's how I want to phrase the next part of this conversation, Stephen, because you have a lot of thoughts about that are very insightful. So let's just jump right into the Bitcoin and gold controversy.
Well, I think when it comes to Bitcoin itself and gold, I don't think it's really a contest. I mean, I think that gold is much more essential as a it's a currency. It's already defined as a currency by the Bank of International Settlements. It sits on balance sheets of banks as a currency. There's a big difference between how American banks have taken advantage of this and how Chinese banks have. And that difference, again, very unfortunately, dramatically favors the Chinese, because they're able to offset whatever assets they hold in gold by deposits, because China and the Chinese basically, they like gold, they acquire it, they do it for investment purposes, and they use banks as a vehicle for storing it. The importance here is that banks are then able to hold gold assets, and as a result, they can use gold as a risk-free asset that basically helps them satisfy all these risk ratios that banks must satisfy in today's world. That was a result of, I think this is called Basel III, and it these are regulations put out by the Bank of International Settlements. Again, that bank, you know, the initials BIS, is often referred to as the central bank's central bank. They make regulations that govern what banks across the globe should do in order to have adequate protection. And gold in that, and gold as a result of the coming regulations or institution of the coming regulations, which is just in another couple of months that they may be gradually phased in, are definitely going to favor banks that have gold and have gold depositors. And that means the East is going to be favored by that. But also, there's much more to it than just that. I mean, gold has a history that goes back thousands of years as a currency, as a store of value, as something that cannot be counterfeited, as something that, you know, represents real value. And unlike any other commodity, it's valued for its own self. It's valued because people, you know, maybe they regard its beauty as something that is special, something that is, you know, if you go back and read some of these dialogues in, excuse me, in Plato and, you know, other Greek philosophers, you know, gold's mentioned, rejected, but still mentioned as something that represents true beauty. And it has this aura about it that basically transcends the ages. It has outlasted, you know, every kind of scourge that has affected mankind over the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, from the plague to who knows how many wars, etc. You can't say the same about any other currency. And so gold deserves, and I think will have, a major role to play in the next reserve currency. I mean, the dollar, for reasons that, you know, I tried to make clear at the beginning, cannot serve that role anymore. It just can't. We don't have access to the commodities that we need to run the country as it is. And with commodity prices going up by leaps and bounds, you know, that condition is getting worse. So that, you know, the dollar will play a role, I think, in a future reserve currency, but it can no longer be the only reserve currency. You will probably have some sort of basket, and my guess is that basket will be backed up by gold. And incidentally, as kind of a sidebar, if you're in China right now, the Chinese are already de facto, they don't make a big point about this, not at all, but de facto, gold is already backing up the yuan. It will back up the digital yuan, which is coming around the bend. It's being tested as we talk. And anyone in China that holds yuan can actually exchange that yuan for gold. So that's what you mean by backing things up. The next step would be to have a basket of currencies, and that basket, you know, to the extent that, you know, money or that basket ends up in China, it's held by somebody domiciled or visiting China in their, you know, international trading zones, would be able to exchange that basket for gold. And so that's coming together. Now, the question that you ask, Cheryl, I mean, there's no real competition. It's really silliness, and it's doing no one any good to, you know, go around saying Bitcoin versus gold. It's not really Bitcoin versus gold. It's that, is there a role for cryptocurrency in this world? Bitcoin has none of the character, I mean, has very few of the characteristics which would suggest that it would be a currency. One thing, front and center, unlike gold, unlike, you know, other currencies, it can be counterfeited. It could be, you know, undermined. The whole ecostructure of Bitcoin could be undermined very, very quickly. And the reason that happens or could happen is that the Chinese control like 65% of the mining of Bitcoin. And immediately, this has to cause you to say, well, wait a second, because China doesn't allow Bitcoin to be traded in any of their exchanges. There might be an over-the-market exchange, that over-the-counter exchange, you know, small markets. But, you know, in this country, we trade Bitcoin almost 24/7. In China, you're not, you know, that doesn't go on. So why is China the biggest miner of Bitcoin? Well, they're the biggest miner of Bitcoin because they have, you know, tremendous numbers of computers. They have a lot of cheap energy, which, you know, facilitates mining. And, and they have established the preeminent position as the miner of Bitcoin, 65% again. Now, if you add in other countries that are friendly to China's and friendly to China's aims, which are to create a reserve currency apart from the dollar, and not necessarily, obviously, Bitcoin not included, or else they'd be, you know, more active in the Bitcoin market, but still they control a market that they basically don't use. Why do they do that? Well, because they can basically, look, what happened to Jack Ma is illustrative of, one of the problems with China. They're an autocracy, and as an autocracy, they can make a lot of what they want to happen, happen. And if they want to destroy Bitcoin, they will have no trouble doing it. And without getting technical about it, what they can in effect do, no one can change the history of what has taken place with Bitcoin in the sense that all the past transactions are recorded on something called a blockchain. And that really can never be hacked. But what can change is going forward, if 51% of the people that mine Bitcoin agree to it, they can create a so-called double spend. Actually, it could be converted to a multiple spend where, you know, one Bitcoin is created and it basically is can be used in, you know, by different people to do, you know, whatever they want to do. There's nothing unique about it. It would be like, you know, my example, you could create a situation like this with respect to Bitcoin, where you have a dollar bill, let's say, and you go to 30 different coffee shops and you give the same dollar to, you know, the proprietor of the shop, get a cup of coffee, he gives you back the dollar, and you go to another coffee shop and get another cup of coffee. And you can do this as many times as you want with the same dollar. It's counterfeit. And a currency that you can so easily counterfeit, and this is fairly easy to do in a place called China. You need 51%. You don't need all the miners. You need 51% out of 65. I mean, that's a little over 80% of the miners, but you don't even need that many because, you know, other countries like Russia, like Iran, like Malaysia, they also have a number of miners. So, you know, between China and China's friends, again, people that are like-minded, they probably control 85% of the miners. China can basically, you know, lead the destruction of Bitcoin tomorrow and have, you know, run for cover if everyone blames China. Say, look, it was Iran. It was all these other countries that were participating. You know, they don't even have to own up to it. And these miners will very nicely fit in to other jobs that will probably be needed as China launches its own digital currency. So owning Bitcoin is a terrible thing to do. I mean, and, you know, there are other horrible reasons for having Bitcoin other than running this crazy risk. I don't know why anyone in their right mind would want to do this, but they do. And, you know, people, to make a buck today, they'll do, you know, they'll just ignore a whole bunch of other things. And, you know, they're also ignoring not to, you know, how energy intensive Bitcoin is. I mean, it's so hypocritical to see people like Elon Musk. Now, he's walked back his interest in Bitcoin because I think he sort of gets the message about China. So he said, well, I made some money, but it's really just a temporary substitute for cash. I mean, he's walking it back. But why people like Musk who's walking it back, but there are other people that around our financial institutions, you know, they're preaching energy conservation and all these other, you know, good stuff about, you know, limiting the amount of energy, and yet are advocating a currency which, if it ever really took off, would consume a very meaningful amount of energy. I mean, technology itself, even if Bitcoin doesn't take off, you know, go up much higher as people are telling everybody that it will. If Bitcoin did this, it's likely that, you know, it will consume a significant portion of electricity in the world. It's already consuming, you know, quite a bit of electricity in the world. And technology as a whole is likely to consume maybe 20% of the world's electricity, you know, by the end of this decade. Now, you add what Bitcoin may contribute to that, and you're going to have a problem. Because, you know, some people argue, well, this will just encourage people to further develop solar. Not so fast. I mean, solar only represents 5% of the energy. We're going to have to really develop it. I mean, it's not so easy to develop it. That's the major problem. The more energy you use, I don't care what it is, whether it's cheap energy, expensive energy, the more energy you use for something that's useless is Bitcoin. Is energy that's wasted and is energy that's going to have to be created from another source. And that's what people have to realize. And it's hopefully they'll realize it soon enough so that this doesn't impede, you know, what we want to do in this world, which is gravitate toward renewable energies. Now, if you want to ask me about cryptocurrencies in general, those that are not so vulnerable to what China wants and almost surely will do are some of the cryptos like Ethereum. That's where I might look. Look, I'm not denying the fact that this is a very, very dangerous world. I mean, we talked earlier about, you know, the turmoil that one can expect in the years ahead. And you know, buying gold, if you want to, you know, if you're very worried about what's happening now, I'd recommend buying physical gold. And bars, et cetera, and having a cryptocurrency to, you know, perhaps be able to transfer some of these holdings or facsimiles of, you know, around to other people, maybe even other countries, might not be a bad idea. Now, you're not going to have the kind of protection you have with Bitcoin if you use Ethereum, but it works. I mean, it's not a bad idea. I mean, I have to do, frankly, a little bit more research on Ethereum to, you know, really say that it's something that's critical for people to have a stake in. But it's much, much cheaper than Bitcoin, even though it's been around, I think, equally long, if I'm not mistaken. And their algorithm is, you know, not as is obtuse and hard to solve, and doesn't consume nearly as much electricity as does Bitcoin, and it can't be shut down by China. That's the very, very important thing. You know, unfortunately, as with Bitcoin, Ethereum, any crypto can be used for nefarious sorts of acts. That's why, you know, whenever you see these ransomware issues, they're always done in terms of Bitcoin, you know, that's the nature of the world. People are going to steal, they're going to, you know, break laws, and if you don't have cryptocurrencies around, they'll probably use some other way of doing it. But you know there might be a decent case to make for some cryptos. There is no case, in my opinion, to make for Bitcoin, and I think there might be a case made for Coinbase, which is an exchange that trades a lot of these cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin. But even without Bitcoin, Coinbase, which recently went public with a very high valuation, could be a decent investment. I'm not recommending it, but I'm just saying I wouldn't throw that out necessarily. But Bitcoin is singularly dangerous. I mean, unless you know something about the Chinese government and why in the world would a government control something for just the purposes of controlling it? I mean, it doesn't make any sense, especially when they have their own digital currency coming and they don't want anything to interfere with that, especially Bitcoin, and they have the power now to just shut it down. You know, I'm not predicting when that's going to happen, but it will happen whenever it's convenient for the Chinese to do it. So, you know, answer to your question is that there really is no, in my opinion, there should be no debate between Bitcoin and gold. It's just silly. There's no case you can make that Bitcoin represents a real currency. Not when it's controlled by a government that has no stake in it being a currency. It's insane, and it rises to the level of being utterly silly. That doesn't mean it won't go up higher. It just means the higher it goes, if it went to $200,000, $300,000, it's going to be consuming so much energy. And when it fall comes, it's going to be that much harder and create that much more chaos. So it's just a terrible investment. But other cryptos, that's a different story. I'm not against the idea of privacy and protecting yourself and having ways of communicating over secure blockchains and transferring things, contracts over secure blockchains. I'm all for that. I am all in, 100% in. And, you know, my feeling is that Ethereum and other cryptos probably are all right. So, you know, I hope that answers your question.
Well, yeah, that was a tremendous amount of insight. And, you know, we're coming right to the end of the show. There's just so much you've given us to think about. I don't think anyone really has understood to what degree China controls Bitcoin and has the potential to disrupt it, to destroy it, to, you know, be devastating to
notice.
The investments. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
whenever
that
might
said,
take a little time, but it's China. It's the East. It's China, Iran, Russia. You know, countries that are friendly with China that and are like-minded. They have, you know, not only they have motivation to. And they may decide, incidentally, you know, you can, you know, if you're a conspiracy buff, and I'm not really, you could imagine China encouraging Bitcoin to go to $100,000 or $200,000 and then come down against it and watch the chaos follow in the U.S. I mean, you know, that could happen. Why would Elon Musk initially start recommending Bitcoin, knowing China's position on it? Maybe he was told. This would be a good idea, would serve our purposes. So, you know, what I'm predicting about China and the destruction of Bitcoin is not something that I'm predicting that will happen tomorrow, but it's going to happen. And the higher it goes, the more, you know, we're just exposing ourselves. It's crazy. It's just crazy. Sorry.
Well, you know, I just so appreciate the perspective that you have, Stephen, and that you're willing to share it with us. And look, everyone has to go into the research and evaluate it, but you've given more insight and depth to this situation, I think, than most people have had access to. And that's what we want, right? We want to get educated and make educated decisions. So if people want to know more about you, they can go to your website, which is Stephen, and that's S-T-E-P-H, Stephen with P-H-E-N-L-E-E-B.com. Do you still have your newsletter? Else can people?
The newsletter, which is, you know, also represented on the website, is called The Complete Investor. And there's another one called Real World, which actually does recommend a lot of commodity stocks and gold, but you won't find Bitcoin among those recommendations.
No, I don't think so. Well, that's great. So start by going to Stephen's website, StephenLeeb.com. Get educated, make wise choices. These are the times when we really need to be as educated as possible. So, again, Dr. Stephen Leeb, thank you for your expertise, your insights, and your generosity in sharing them with us today.
It was my pleasure, Cheryl. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank everyone listening. We'll see you again next week. I look forward to another transforming conversation on What Women Must Know. And until then, may your week be filled with love, peace, and harmony. And bye for now.